I'm June Hamburg, and coming up on my Let Me Tell You podcast is one of America's greatest storytellers, Mitch Albom. You've got to stay tuned and listen to it. One of America's best storytellers is at it again, Mitch Albom, the next person you are going to meet in heaven. And I'm lucky enough to have grabbed Mitch for a sit-down interview for Let Me Tell You, our original OG podcast network. So you are going to be fascinated at this story. And also, Mitch, a sportscaster, how he changed his life by meeting someone, an old professor of his, and was inspired by, despite the illness this man was facing, his optimism, his love for life, his enthusiasm, life lessons that we can all learn. So I do want you to be there. Just go to the OG Podcast Network and you can get everything. Then, you know, Jones Week, of course, it always involves a lot of food. And my son was in from L.A., and he showed up with two huge shopping bags. I said, what's in the bags? Unlike him, he travels light. He said, Dim Sun, you have one of the great places. It's a Michelin-starred restaurant. It's real Chinese. It's a Cantonese name. It's Tim Ho Wong, one of the leading dim sum people in the world. And its name in Cantonese means add good luck. It arrived near Union Square, 85 4th Avenue, 212-228-2800, Tim Ho Wong. Guys, you know, I love dumplings and I love dim sum. This was so unbelievably delicious. Steamed pork dumplings with shrimp, vegetable dumplings, pork spare ribs with black bean sauce, but they're tiny and delicate. The best turnip cakes I think I've ever had. And it just got better and better. Stuffed and steamed rice rolls with shrimp and Chinese chives and barbecue. Cheap. These wonderful portions from $1 to $4. Really delicious. So put this on your list. You would never know. This is a Michelin-starred restaurant. And it's very rare to have this kind of dim sum. Things that melt in your mouth. If you are going to be an adventurer, you might try the chicken feet. Or their fame, their pork buns stuffed with barbecued pork. Now, my son doesn't like sweet, so he thought it was too sweet. I love sweet. I was happy as a lark. You are going to eat yourself for like, what, $10 a person or something? It was fantastic. Problem is, the New Yorker found it, so they wrote about it. And one night, my kid said, the line was like five blocks down. Tim Ho Wong, 85 4th Avenue, I had to tell you, 212-228-2800. You can't make a reservation, but you can just call up and ask how long the line is. Anyway, I've got such a good podcast for you today that I want you to stay right here, dream of pork buns, and go on Mitch Albom's wild adventures that really have a positive impact on people's lives. I'm Joan Hamburg, and thanks for sharing Let Me Tell You. All right, everyone, welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And a famous author and really good person, Mitch Albom, is not only a writer of books, screenwriter, a playwright, he's a syndicated columnist. He had one of the most successful books ever on the New York Times list, Tuesdays with Maury. And he has a new book out called The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. And this is a sequel. And I'm curious, Mitch, who's got so much going on, including charity, he is involved. He operates an orphanage in Haiti where he's incredibly involved. Some of his books and stories have been made into television series and movies. He lives in Detroit. So welcome to you. I haven't talked to you in a while.
Hi, Joan. How are you?
I'm good. And what made you do it? Do it again.
A sequel, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I've never written a sequel, Joan. As you know, most of my books just sort of begin and end. But The Five People You Meet in Heaven, which I wrote 15 years ago, of all the books I've written, probably was the one I heard the most from my readers about, you know, well, so what happened next? It was a story of an old man named Eddie who dies trying to save a little girl named Annie from an amusement park accident. And he pushes her out of the way at the last second from a falling cart, and he's killed, but he doesn't know if he saves her. And he goes to heaven, and he meets five people. He finds out this is the first stage of heaven, where you meet five people from your life, some of whom you might know, some of whom might be total strangers to you. And they explain how something you did with them changed their lives forever and his life forever. And so he goes through and sort of finds out that this nothing life he thought he led was very meaningful. So after that book came out and became pretty widely popular, much to my surprise, a lot of people would write and ask, well, what's the second stage of that?
Right, what happened?
Can't just leave Eddie there. And what happened to the little girl? So after 15 years and some recent losses in my life, my mind was sort of on heaven anyhow, and I decided to revisit it.
And here we have The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. But you had once told me that Eddie, who in this case was the technician working for the Carnival the Rides, is a real person predicated on your own relative.
That's right. He was an old uncle of mine named Eddie. He was a World War II vet, like the character in the book. He always talked like this and said he was a nobody, never did nothing, never went nowhere. And I always felt terrible for him because I loved him. And to me, he was a hero, but he never thought a lot of himself. So the kind of message of the first book was that there's no such thing as a nobody. And maybe you find out in heaven that a lot of little things that you did in life had enormous effects on people. And this book, I decided to follow the story of Annie, the little girl who was saved. Because I always found, Joan, it was an interesting idea that, you know, what happens if you're early in your life, you are saved by somebody who dies instead of you? You know, how do you...
Right, the trauma of that.
Yeah. And so this follows her life. And it turns out that the accident was so traumatic that she only vaguely remembers it. But she knows that she started that day one way and she ended it another way. And for the rest of her life, she feels like all she does is make mistakes,
right,
dating back to that mistake and then all these other mistakes in high school and with relationships and jobs. And when she dies, similarly in the first book, you know, in a kind of tragic way, at the beginning of the book, she goes to heaven, starts on her five-person journey, thinking everything she did was a mistake, and she has shown, no, that wasn't a mistake, that led to this, and this wasn't a mistake, led to that. And, of course, one of the five people she meets is Eddie.
But, you know, Mitch, even though everyone knows you, I'm talking to Mitch Albom with his brand-new book, and it's getting a lot of press, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. I just want to remind the audience, when you did your first book, which became this huge bestseller, you were a sports writer living a very different life.
Right.
So what happened to you? What made you do even that book?
Well, you know, that's why I'm sort of a walking example of how your life can get turned around by any one event or given person. So as you correctly said, until I was 37, I was totally immersed in sports. I wrote sports for a newspaper. I was on ESPN, a radio show. Everything I did was sports. And I was extremely ambitious and very, very hardworking at my own career. And then one night, as life would have it, I happened to flip the channels. And on Nightline, I did a double take because there was an old professor of mine, white-haired and sickly-looking, named Maury Schwartz. And he was talking to Ted Koppel about what it was like to die. And Maury and I had been very close in college, very close. I took every class he offered. I majored in sociology because of him. I would eat at his house, and I mean, he said to me, "Promise you'll stay in touch." And then, of course,
like a
lot of ambitious people. Right, I didn't. And so I contacted him after that, went to see him what I thought would be a one-time visit, but I was so taken with the peace that he had with how he was dying, even though this was a terrible disease, ALS.
He
couldn't move his legs, barely could move his arms, but he was still fascinated by what was happening at the end of his life. He likened it to being a leaf that just before it dies turns colorful, you know, really bright and yellows and oranges. And he felt like he was living the most comfortable stretch of his life and colorful stretch of his life, even as he reached the end. And so I wrote a book that was not supposed to be a big book, Joan. It was a tiny little book that I used to pay his medical bills because he didn't have money to pay his bills. And it was really the first nice thing, to be honest, that I had ever done for somebody else purely for the purpose of helping them. And I planned on going back to being a sports writer.
Right, that was your life.
Yeah, and then the book came out and became something else. And suddenly people didn't want to talk to me about sports. They wanted to tell me about their sister who died from cancer, and the last thing they did was read Tuesdays with Maury together. And you have that happen to you time and time again every day of your life multiple times. You start to become sensitized to the loss in the world and how people are feeling the frustration in their lives and the things that they're losing. And sports starts to seem very trivial. Not that it's not worth doing or fun or anything like that, but when it came time to write books, I didn't want to write sports books anymore. And that led me to The Five People You Meet in Heaven, which was a novel. And fortunately, I was fortunate that that was successful. And I've been going from there.
But it's really interesting because here we have Mitch Albom, who by now is an incredibly successful author and playwright and screenwriter. But you have always been about living and about understanding and changing people's lives. So the logical question is, why is death such a major part of what you write about and think about?
Because, Joan, unless you really recognize that death is out there, you don't really focus on living in perspective. You know, we all think we're going to live forever. And, you know, I liken it to like when you're on the road, you're driving, and all of a sudden somebody, you know, cuts in front of you and you almost have an accident, but you just fortunately don't. And then when you catch your breath, you say, oh, my God, and you come home and you say, my life flashed before my eyes. I'm going to do everything differently now. I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to call my old friends.
Right.
I'm going to be a better person. I've been given the second lease on life. And, of course, it lasts for about a week, and then you go back to the way you were. But why does that happen? Because you really look death in the face and you said, wow, this could all end. I don't write about death, Joan. And to me, serial killer writers write about death. Yeah, I write about life, but death is usually used to make us reflect on life. And just as Maury was dying, and yet I never met anybody more alive than Maury, and he was down to his final minutes. So I think, you know, the perspective of death is something I use, but I don't tell stories about death. I tell stories about life and how to live it better.
Mitch Albom, and then at what point did you get involved in Haiti? I know that you became very successful with the first venture out of sports, and you were always involved in the charity world, but you really now were big time. So what brought you to Haiti?
The earthquake in 2010. I've been operating a number of charities in Detroit, and I still do. And after the earthquake in 2010, there was a Detroit pastor who had operated an orphanage there, and I flew down to just sort of see if I could help, and I was so taken by the
children
there that I ended up flying workmen down month after month to build the first toilets there, the first showers, the first kitchen, ultimately the first school. And after a few months, I ended up taking over the whole operation, and now I'm there every month for 3 or 4 days. We have 47 children. We raise them. They eat 3 meals a day. They have good sleeping conditions. They go to school 7 hours a day in English and French. And my goal is to get them all college educated, in the States or there, and then to go back to their country and turn their lives around.
Exactly.
And put an end to what brought them to us in the first place.
And in Haiti, it's not, when people hear you run an orphanage, I'm sure you get requests for adoption, but it's very difficult to adopt a Haitian child.
Yeah, no, we don't do any adoptions. That's impossible. That's a whole other world. We raise the children. We call it an orphanage because that's the word that's used, and most of our kids are orphans.
Uh-huh.
Some of them were left to die out in the fields. And I've learned so much from these kids including one particular that was sort of dedicated the book to.
Was that the little girl you took in?
Yeah, she had a DIPG brain tumor, and we brought her in at 5 years old. We brought her up to America, and she became our daughter. And we spent the next 2 years traveling the world trying to cure her. And what she taught me in those 2 years about, you know, what makes a family and how you can start a family at any stage of your life with any child. They don't have to look like you. Don't have to talk like you. And the loss of her when she finally passed away is very much imbued in this book. If I can give you a 30-second example, because this is really what I learned from it as well, and maybe people who have lost people who are listening to your show can take something from it. At one point, Annie is complaining about all the losses she's had in her life and the loved ones who have died or the heartbreak that she suffered. And the character that she's talking to takes out these pipe cleaners, which play a part in the book. And he takes one pipe cleaner and he makes this very small, little, perfectly shaped heart. And he says, you see this heart? It's small, it's unlined, it's perfect. It's been through nothing. This is the heart that we're born with. Then he takes the other four pipe cleaners and he makes a much larger heart, but with crosses all crisscrossing and lines all across. And he says, you see this heart? This is the heart we die with. And Annie says, but it's all broken. And he says, yes, many times. And she says, so that's what ruins it. And he says, no, that's what makes it whole. And I have had to adopt that philosophy to the losses in my life, having lost our little girl, my mother, and my father in a 3-year stretch.
Wow, you had a lot.
I had to sort of get philosophical about it. And that is my chosen way of looking at it, that yes, we all have these lines on our heart. That's what comes with living. But those cracks allow the light to come in and show you that you need to cherish the time that you still have, cherish the relationships that you still have, appreciate the people who are still with you and the time that you do have. And if we didn't lose anything, then yeah, our hearts would all look like the little kid's heart, but we'd also expect nothing. We'd appreciate nothing because like little kids, we'd think everything goes on forever. So part of living your life is to get these breaks in your heart, but that also is what makes it a complete life and an appreciative life. And I've had to learn that, and I hope that that's a lesson that people who read The Next Person You Meet in Heaven can take with them.
Mitch Albom has written many books, nonfiction and fiction. His Tuesdays with Maury, I think I read somewhere, it's the best-selling memoir of all times. Multi millions of copies of all his books, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven, his latest. Tell me a little bit about what's going on in Detroit, which I have some ties to, and it's been a tough road for this city.
Yes, but interestingly, Joan, it's starting to come back. There's a very thriving downtown because it got to the point where you could get a house in downtown for $7,000.
Yeah, I know, unreal.
And so, you know, at some point it hits the bottom and starts to bounce back up, and there's a lot of young people who now have moved into downtown Detroit, and if you were to walk on a couple of the main streets in downtown, it actually starts